paid into Medicare for decades. Don't spend retirement limping. The Joint Relief Institute treats joint pain fast. It's covered by Medicare. Call 708-888-0000.
Time for This Week in Chicago History with Anna DeVlantis, and we'll start by going back 63 years. Wow, that's when the river first turned green, huh, Anna?
Yeah, maybe you were there, Bob. I don't know. This week, 1962, the Chicago River was dyed green for St. Paddy's Day for the very first time, and the tradition has been carried out, as we know, other than maybe a few years there during COVID, by the Chicago Journeymen's Plumbers Union every year since. Yeah, this one's the 63rd year this Saturday. Interesting to note, though, Bob, if you go back and look, in 1962, that very first year, Mayor Daley instructed city crews to not dye the river. He wanted them to dye Lake Michigan. And so that was the original task. He's like, let's dye the lake. Let's dye the whole thing green.
Oh, wow.
But they settled on a much more manageable river task, and they thought it'd be easier to pull off, and they did. And if you dig even deeper to this practice of using dye in the river, that goes back even farther. You know, you go to 1950s, WTTW did a deep dive into the backstory of dyeing the river. And, of course, we know it's orange powder that turns green, and that's what they use today. But back then, they were using green dye, the city crews, to try to figure out, suss out, like, the toxins in the water. You know, for so many years, the river had been used as basically a dumping ground for the slaughterhouses and industrial and commercial waste. And Mayor Daley had this vision that we're going to clean that up. So we're going to make that an entertainment destination for the city. So, hey, city crews, get out there and remove all that sludge, get all the toxins out of there. And they used a green dye. Their outfits were stained with green when they go, you know, back home from work. And that inspired someone else in the city to say, you know what, let's try that and see if we could actually do this for St. Patrick's Day. Here's a clip from WTTW, the history behind dyeing the Chicago River green.
Business manager Stephen Bailey got the idea from seeing a plumber in stained green coveralls. Bailey and his pal, Mayor Richard J. Daley, initially considered dyeing Lake Michigan before ultimately picking a portion of the more manageably sized Chicago River. Bailey waxed poetic, telling reporters the dye would connect the city to Ireland, flowing from the Chicago to the Illinois River, onto the Mississippi, up the Gulf Stream, and across the Atlantic into the Irish Sea. The exact dye recipe has always been a closely guarded secret. Other U.S. cities have taken the idea, dyeing their own rivers and canals each March. And with thousands gathering along the Chicago River every year to see it all unfold, the tradition doesn't seem ready to die anytime soon.
Before they cleaned up the river, it was all kinds of colors, wasn't it? Not very pretty.
And smelly. And, you know, I mean, we remember. It just, you know, it has come a long way in a little bit of time. So grateful for that. And this Saturday, you can go out there and watch it happen yet again.
A lot of us remember, I think we still connect downtown with places like Goldblatt's, and this is a big date in Chicago history as far as that department store is concerned, isn't it?
You know, Bob, did you shop at Goldblatt's? Do you have memories of that?
I don't know that I ever bought anything there, but I certainly remember the store.
It's interesting because you go back and some people have such fond memories of going with their parents or their grandparents or going themselves to Goldblatt's to go shopping. It was the huge State Street flagship store opened this week 90 years ago. And even though it was the height of the Depression, 10,000 people in Chicago showed up for this ribbon cutting and then flooded the store after. There was so much excitement. And the reason was Marshall Fields was like the gold standard in retail shopping. It was the high end, the elegant clothing, the latest fashions, but elegant price tags as well. Goldblatt's was the blue collar alternative, completely affordable. They, you know, it was right at Ashland in Chicago when they first started, but then they moved to 50 locations ultimately across the Chicago area. They would run these ads in the Tribune that would get people so excited about these huge sales, $1,000 dyed designer dresses for $29.99. And it was just like a carnival when you went in there on the sales day because they'd serve you popcorn and they'd have these huge racks of suits that were like, oh my gosh, they're designer suits, but they're only $30. And then they'd tie the shoes together by the shoelaces and just pile them on top of tables, and you'd sort through them for your size. But they were cheap, and so for years it became such a destination. They'd sound a buzzer on when they did their bargain basement sales, and people would rush into the store and grab armfuls of clothing and then try them on in dressing rooms. It's so interesting to see the arc of retail, because I think that might have inspired like the blue light specials at Walmart and, you know, the mm-hmm. Kmarts and all those other discounters over the year. I know styles changed and times changed, but Goldblatt's really was a thing back in the day.
I think I remember my mom dragging me in there. I'm not sure, but I think so.
I kind of remember the popcorn or something, because I remember there was food items to be had.
Exactly.
I don't remember the clothes so much.
This was a big week for Bonnie Hunt in 1982. Tell us about that.
Just love Bonnie Hunt. 23 years old in 1982, a nurse at Northwestern Medicine, and she got her first job as a nurse, and life would have gone on as a nurse, being a nurse for Bonnie Hunt, but she just had this bug for comedy and really just loved it. She said nursing was so rewarding, but emotionally just draining and heavy. So she started a comedy troupe with her fellow doctors and nurses to bring some levity to their lives. And she just loved comedy. Actually, true story, Bob, she turned down an invitation to join Second City at first because that wasn't really her style. It was too structured and it wasn't her, she thought. She joined a few years later, and that ultimately launched her first role in Hollywood. We pulled a clip of a young Bonnie Hunt on the Johnny Carson show. She is fresh out of Chicago's Second City, making her way as an actress in Hollywood. And oh, by the way, fellow Second City alum Martin Short happens to be on the couch next to her.
You're new to television. Somebody said you came out of Second City in Chicago?
Yes, I started in Chicago.
Yeah.
My husband's still out there, actually.
Yeah.
Which is fine, because once the career takes off, we'll probably get divorced. You know?
And you do have a husband in Chicago, right?
Yes.
Now, is he still there? He really is there?
Yes, he is. I go back there whenever I can just to...
They say that's good for a marriage, though, to spend a certain amount of time apart.
I think even when we're
home.
Year
here, year there.
But I was a nurse, you know, for a while.
I didn't know. Somebody said you were going to be a nurse. Mm-hmm. Young girls do that. When kids want to be boys, want to be firemen or dying, girls want to be nurses.
Yeah, well, my father, when I told him I wanted to go in show business, he said, great, go to nursing school. So,
were your parents supportive? When most kids would tell their parents, I want to go in the entertainment business, they'd try to say, no, it's cruel, you have to learn rejection. Were they supportive when you went in, or did they try to talk you out of it?
Well, I think my dad was a little nervous about it, just because, you know, being a woman, and he wasn't a woman.
No, maybe. I understand.
And, but my mother worked at NBC in Chicago.
I didn't know
for about 12 years, and now she works at Shriners Hospital in Chicago.
Everybody loves Bonnie.
Haven't
talked to her in a while, but she's the best. She's the real deal, isn't she?
She is. Just love her. She got a small role in Rain Man, Bob, by the way, while she was on her lunch break. She auditioned while she was still a nurse, and that was kind of the beginning for her. Such a cool story.
On the day you're mine.
The very first performer at the Playboy Club in Chicago. Anna?
Mabel Mercer was her name. She was, you're right, Bob, the very first one to take to the stage there at the legendary Playboy Club, opening its doors this week, 1960, at 116 East Walton. That was the original location. That was a building that was leased by Bulls and Blackhawks owner Arthur Wirtz. Just upscale food, world-class entertainment, and servers dressed in like skimpy bunny out costumes. And that was the formula that led to such big success for Hugh Hefner. The whole town was talking about it. The whole world was eventually talking about it. Hugh Hefner already was a successful publisher at this point. 7 years earlier, he had launched Playboy kind of out of his dorm room at U of I, and he started selling millions of copies. So it was such a thing that was such a successful thing. And then the Playboy Club was an extension of that brand. He'd issue those $25 keys, gold keys, to people so that they'd get a key to the club and they'd be members. It was pretty revolutionary at the time. Nearly 17,000 people, Bob, visited the Playboy Club just in its first month of operation. Here's Hugh Hefner back in the day talking about the original Playboy Club in Chicago.
When we opened the first Playboy Club in February of 1960, the city of Chicago didn't want to give us a license. We had to go to court to get that. They objected to the bunny. And they objected first and foremost, I think, simply to the concept of Playboy.
Hefner won that round, too. The Playboy Club was an instant success. Marley Renfro made her way to Chicago after playing Janet Leigh's body double in Psycho. She posed for Playboy and found work at the new club.
You go to any bar in town, and a mixed drink was 35 cents. The Playboy Club charged $1.50. Nobody complained.
Wonder if Hef set up a shower for her at the Playboy Club in Chicago.
That's an
interesting tidbit. Yeah, wow. And that was this week in 1960. Happy birthday today, Common, huh?
Common is 53rd birthday this week, Bob. He originally was called Common Sense, born on the South Side, Hyde Park area, grew up and started his rap career as a teenager. Real name, Lonnie Rashid Lynn, went to Luther High School. First album was Can I Borrow a Dollar? And he's made a few dollars since, Bob, I think. Common has been releasing albums just regularly. He's a successful actor as well. Early on, got a couple of really interesting music connections to Chicago. Collaborated with Kanye West on his multi-platinum debut album, College Dropout, and has continued to have a close relationship with him. Also, he is now dating Jennifer Hudson, Chicago's own fellow Southsider. He hinted he may no longer be a bachelor soon, which is pretty huge. Here he is. He doesn't talk in detail, but here he is talking about their Chicago connections.
We proud to both be from Chicago, and I always respect it. When I first saw her, I was like, man, she is dope. She come from Inglewood. Like, that ain't no joke, man. And I was like, this woman got something about her that's soulful. But, you know, we never connected in that way. You know, we did some work together, but not a lot. Somebody who I truly do respect. Keeping it chill, keeping it, you know, I don't talk too much about it. But you know, when you meet people from where you from, you kind of, y'all got an unspoken, like, language that's there. And there's something about that that's kind of cool, man. Because I don't think I've been in a relationship with anybody from Chicago and since high school.
Wow, that's crazy.
Maybe Common will put a brownie on his birthday cake tomorrow.
That's a good way to celebrate.
Yeah.
Or the atomic cake, Bob. I heard this. Producer Joe told me that your text line was blowing up when we talked about the atomic cake.
Oh, yes.
Right?
Everybody remembers it, especially on the South Side, as you pointed out.
Yeah, like you and I, Northsiders, we didn't know the atomic cake, but apparently south of Roosevelt, it was huge.
Mm-hmm. And as far as the brownie is concerned, it was invented right here, wasn't it?
Right here, Chicago-born dessert. Bertha Palmer, the wife of Palmer Potter, who started the Palmer House, introduced them for the World's Fair. She was tasked by the board of directors, Bob, to just say, we need a dessert that fairgoers can hold in their hand as they walk through the fair, and she came up with the brownie. By the way, the original had apricot jelly on it. Hmm. And do you like nuts in your brownie?
No.
No,
I'm a purist.
No.
Mm-hmm.
No, the original had walnuts, Bob. The original had walnuts.
Okay.
Marianne would like that because it adds a little health to the whole thing. Yeah, you get a little nuts.
That's right. 1893, the first brownie introduced this week in Chicago. You've made us hungry again. Thank you, Anne. I'll talk to you next week again.